Welcome to A Spiro Life for July 1st, 2011. The intention with A Spiro Life is to share with you the latest and most up-to-date insights of the changes taking place on our planet. We invite your feedback and comments as to what would assist you as we move towards this collective awakening. If gaining deeper insight into your life is something you value, I would be happy to assist you. My practice focuses on people understanding themselves and those around them at a much deeper level. Through numerology and astrology, we examine the patterns, conditions, and people at play in your life. If gaining deeper insight into your life is something you value, I would be happy to assist. Now, on with our show. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Carmen Bolter, a professor at the University of Calgary in Canada. Carmen teaches online at the Graduate Division of Educational Research. Carmen has been to 52 countries in search of clues to the lost matriarchal cultures. Her travels and quests have brought her to Egypt 25 times, where she has done extensive research deciphering the symbols and structures of the ancient Egyptians. She is the author of Angels and Archetypes, an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness. She has recently completed a groundbreaking made for TV documentary called The Pyramid Code, which is a 5-hour documentary that gives insight into Egypt in the Golden Age in the distant past and challenges a lot of what we've been taught and shown traditionally. Carmen is just about to launch her Interactive You online community that empowers participants, and that's what we're going to begin speaking about today. So welcome, Carmen.
Hi.
Hi. It was an energetic beginning. Today, I want to begin, I mean, we've got so much ground to cover with your fabulous body of work, but I want to just begin by discussing a few of the things that you and I have talked about recently about your new program, Interactive You, because I think that it's a great segue, into all this information that so many of us are investigating and reading and delving into, but sometimes we have questions about the authenticity or the background or where people are actually getting some of this information. So can you give us a little bit of background about how this came about for you?
Sure. Interactive You is an online platform for teaching courses where the teacher is actually a host, and then there's an interviewee, and then participants can interact by asking questions, and then it leads to projects that are socially active, like doing something to help the environment. So there's a couple of threads that led to this. One is the way the education system is charging huge amounts of tuition, and then a lot of students are coming out with what Gerald Celente calls degrees in worthlessness, and they can't get jobs, and yet they're encumbered with these huge student loans. And then at the end of the day, if they have to employ themselves, they don't know how to do a website, they don't know how to publish, they don't know how to do things. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's a real problem. And so Interactive You will have a series of overarching, theoretically based courses, like for social complexity theory and those sorts of things, but it'll also have a number of how-to courses. How to build a website, how to do academic writing, how to structure an argument, very basic things like how to use Photoshop and those sorts of things. And one of my colleagues, everybody who's on the team were educators and then left the system because the institutionalized education system really isn't so much focused on education as much as it's focused on policy and on the practicality of running a school, and it's not learner-centered, it's teacher-centered. So it's teacher-centered teaching. And what I want to be promoting is the idea of learner-centered learning. And in the traditional system, you deconstruct Shakespeare, you critique something. But in this model, it's constructivist in that you make something, and it's meaning-centered, and you build on what you already know. And so these courses are designed to be inexpensive, and then if people want to move forward and do larger projects and they need more support, then they pay for that direct interaction with a professor that can help them build something that's publishable. Then people can publish to their electronic portfolio, which is something that we can show future employers for them. And also it's based sort of like on an iTunes model. You have your own Interactive View account, and if you publish something and other people want to view it, then they pay something like $2.99 and get to view something that the professors have published or the students have published. And so it's a really fair model that has everybody be a teacher and everybody be a learner eventually. And so I'm really inspired by this. It's being incredibly well received. It's just about to launch, so I'm building the website, but I haven't posted it yet. And I think that there's a lot of promise in it.
Well, and it sounds like as we're going through all these structural changes, I mean, and you have been in the academic world for most of your career, that, you know, these are the places where we need some change happening. So it's not just in government and finance and banking, but higher education is another arena where, you know, we need to see some fundamental changes taking place, because as I've had experience with my children who are not yet at that university level but going through the school system, and they have unique and different challenges, what I'm seeing is that some of these kids, because I'm tied to working with kids with special needs and with learning LDs, when they get to the university situation, they're not prepared in many ways. So it sounds like you're working at preparedness, too, to really be able to put their money where their mouth is when they're doing this research, because some of this stuff comes out and the information isn't there to back it up.
Right. Well, I'll comment on that in a moment, but right away when I started talking about Interactive View, people started saying, well, what about my kids? And one of the things that's true is that there will be no age limit for any course. If you want to take the course, you can take the course if you're 10. But also, in our province, there's no law that says that kids have to go to school. They need to pass provincial exams, but they can do it. There's homeschool networks that feed in, and there's an awful lot of online support. And so we'll have a consultant that perhaps will be able to have elementary and high school classes through Interactive View as well. Now, addressing the other question is that there's a lot of people who are publishing books, self-publishing, and they haven't gone the university route, or even if they have, they haven't been taught writing, correct academic writing, in a way that they back up their statements. And so I've been teaching quantitative research methods for a number of years, and there's a formula that basically, I say it's like a silk necklace, and when you say something and you support it with what somebody else said, you're putting a pearl on the necklace, and eventually you don't see the silk thread anymore, and all your ideas are supported by what other people said, but the thread is yours. And so what a lot of people do is they just don't have a container for their ideas. And what's so is if you structure an argument properly and trace where the backing is, you pretty much can say whatever you like, but there has to be backing. And so a lot of people are talking, what I say is through their hat, in that there's no backing, and they say, well, it's true because I know, and that's not good enough. And so, you know, we have to reference things properly and write correctly in a style that's that has appeal. So there's a lot of people who are appearing on radio shows that are saying, oh, it's in my book, it's in my book. And then you go to the book and there's no backing in there. So I want to support people to be able to write things of substance that matter, to do research that's ethical and also valid, and to measure states of consciousness and at various sacred sites and in certain energy fields and that sort of thing, and report back on something that's concrete.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because you wrote a book, The Pyramid Code, and then that was turned into a documentary, which, as you and I were discussing now, people can find it on Netflix, I believe. So you've done a lot of research, and you've a lot of it...
Sorry.
That's okay.
Can you cut that out? The cutest little dog in the neighborhood. Passing by. Sorry.
That's
can you,
okay.
Can you edit that?
We can. We'll just keep going. That's okay. That's part of being live. But the Pyramid Code that you wrote, you had to do a lot of research. But you were led there by your intuition, and from what I understand from your youth, you were having these reoccurring dreams about Egypt and so on. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And so what I started having past life recall when I was 6 years old, and it turns out when I found costumes and books and stuff that looked like the ancient Egyptians, I realized that it was Egypt, but at first I didn't know what it was. And then I ended up through the Canadian Embassy in Cairo and the Egyptian Embassy in Ottawa, getting permission to go into the archives of the Rare Books Library of the Faculty of Archaeology of Cairo University, where they had the field notes of everyone who's ever done any excavations on the Giza Plateau. So the material was unfiled, but it was in German, English, French, and Arabic. And I spent a whole summer in those archives, along with the archives in the National Museum in Cairo. There's a whole library in there, but you have to have special permission to get in, and the American University at Cairo. And so I spent an entire summer just digging through these archives. So I've done a lot of field work in Egypt as well. And so my premise here is you can get the hypothesis or the hunch through a past life or through some kind of intuition, but then you've got to back it up in the field and back it up with hard data. So the book, that it was a manuscript that led to the Pyramid Code, and it was called Out of the Blue. It was not, there's no book out yet called The Pyramid Code, but I will be teaching courses on it. So there's material on it, but I turned it into a documentary.
Mm-hmm. And so the Pyramid Code, let's talk a little bit about the research that you did, because as you were saying, when you were younger, you had those flashes that then led you as you went through your schooling and investigating all these different aspects that were coming together. As it happens when you're on the right path, all of a sudden all these pieces of the puzzle start coming together, which led you to creating that, the Pyramid Code. So can you talk a little bit about the five parts of that and what exactly that's all about?
Well, sure. And when I first went to Egypt in 1977, I was by myself, but I overheard tour guides talking to tourists, and my stomach would turn. They'd say, oh, this is Ramses, and I'd hear this voice in my head, no, that's not Ramses. And then I started reading everything in sight, and again, my stomach would turn, and I would just get this horrible feeling like I was going to pass out almost, of pressure in my body that was saying, no, this is not the right story. They're coming at it from the wrong place. And I'm like, well, how do I know? Like, what's this voice in my head? And but it was just a strong visceral reaction to the fact that things are not accurate. And they keep repeating that the pyramids were tombs. And there was, all kinds of things that they kept saying. And I thought, that's not what these are for. And so I had to really go through a lot of material more than once and try to sort the seeds and discern, which parts could be true. And so it's been a very circuitous way around to coming to this information. But then I met Hakim Awian, who was an archaeologist and an indigenous wisdom keeper. And, of course, he wasn't going to tell me anything unless I already knew it. But he was my mentor for about 10 years, and I ended up digging and discovering quite a few things, and then he took me out in the field and pointed to things. And one of the things he says in the Pyramid Code is it's not fair to deny what you can see and touch with your own hand. And so he was looking in the field at hardcore evidence of high-level technology and that sort of thing. So the first episode is called The Band of Peace, and it's looking at the pyramid fields that have 22 pyramids that span north and south of the Giza Plateau. So most people only think about the Great Pyramid, and they actually follow a sky-ground correlation, and so that's what's explored in there. And the other thing is that the Nile River used to run right at the foot of the pyramids. There are these long causeways that would go right to the river. And so it's looking at how long in geological time would it take for the river to migrate 8 miles to the east of the Sphinx, which is where it sits now. Mm-hmm. And so when they said 2450 BC was the date of the building of the pyramid, it just never made sense to me. And so we really have to look farther back into a whole different time frame of a golden age where people had 12-strand DNA, they were much more connected and empowered, they were able to do the transmutation of the atom, and things that we're coming upon now. And there's a lot of technology out there that's been repressed. There's 6,000 patents for free energy and teleportation and this sort of thing. So the second episode deals with high-level technology and the evidence of what the ancients did, machine tool marks on stones, acoustic resonance chambers, something that's similar to the Tesla Tower where there's a honeycomb underneath the plateau of passageways that would fill up with water, free energy, non-polluting. And so it's really been my conviction that, we can have free energy, no utilities as well. And then the third episode is a sacred cosmology, where we go on an expedition to Napta Playa, which is a very curious site in literally the middle of nowhere. We had to take jeeps out right on the open desert and go with GPS. And what it is a series of star alignments and a multi-dimensional model of the universe and the solar system and the galaxy that actually has three layers buried. And of course they excavated it and then buried it again, but they did take pictures of it. And so there's alignments to Orion and to Sirius and to the pole star, and then the way the precessional cycle works, it marks out how we would have gone through 26,000 year cycles. And so it's said that that site's 8,000 years old, and I maintain that everything in Egypt is a lot older than you could even perceive. And it's hard for us to grasp that, but basically that's like a map. So we go in and look at how, and then the rest of the episode is about the sacred cosmology. So the Egyptians were basically keyed in on a couple of things. One was the biology of how we got here, and two was the transmutation of the soul and how we left and where we went. And the premise is that that we're star beings. And so the fourth episode is called The Empowered Human, and that's my favorite one because it goes into what abilities the Egyptians had and how there were various times during the dynastic period where the spirituality came back up. So what's so is that the Mayan calendar mirrors the Egyptian dynasties. So 3113 BC is the beginning of the Mayan calendar, and it's also the beginning of the first dynasty in Egypt. So my premise is that this period of time has been the patriarchal experiment, if you will, and it's been about the denigration of the feminine and all things that happen when we separate the two sides of the brain, and what we could do if we put ourselves back together and started using both sides of our brain plus the corpus callosum, which is the connector between the two. So my master's research was mostly about that, and creative thinking and how you have to have two sides of the brain operating. And then Hakim says that we have 360 senses available to us. And I always thought that, you know, there's things that we can do and connect and things that we can know, and it's very much like a muscle. But it goes very much beyond single senses. So synesthesia is hearing a picture or smelling something when you're watching TV that is really about the story. I mean, there's babies that can do this. And so the empowered human is kind of the model for an empowered humanity that we could have now because we have the same DNA as they did. And so that's pretty powerful. And it's interesting how the way the ancient Egyptians thought and what they were capable of is the model for what interactive you can do. And the last episode is called A New Chronology, which is basically saying, okay, but if it's not 2450 BC, then when was it? And, you know, I often say that the last time you painted your house is not the year your house was built. So it could be that there were some changes made in the Great Pyramid in 2450 BC, but it's far, far, far older than that. So I look at a timeline that goes through the astrological ages that takes into account the precessional cycle, which is the significance of December 21st, 2012, is the end of this precessional cycle. But we are being told that we're the smartest we've ever been, but we're at the bottom of the dark of the dark. And that date is when we turn and start heading toward the light. And we all know, particularly in Canada, when we hit winter solstice and it starts to get a few minutes lighter every day, that we feel a whole lot better. And so it could be a precession ago, a precession and a half ago. It could be like, you know, 50,000 years back. And we're not taught how to think about that. And my conviction is that the patriarchy's agenda has been to erase evidence of everything other than itself. Mm-hmm. And so they tell us that we're 5,000 years old and not too much happened before that. And yet we have people like Michael Cremo with Forbidden Archaeology that are pulling up things that are much, much older. And again, if it doesn't fit with the system and the, you know, the textbooks and what we're told to think, it gets thrown out. And so that basically covers the five episodes.
I mean, I have so many questions with regards to that. And as an astrologer, when we're talking about, when you're mentioning the precession of the equinox, there's a couple of things that I want to touch on with that. One of the things I'd like you to address is, you know, there's, you've talked about this, and there's evidence of the sky-ground correlation in Egypt. But how does that, it hasn't shifted, it's only 8 miles that the Nile has moved in the last however many 1,000 years. So just talk a little bit about the precession of the equinox and how, because in some star systems, the alignment isn't there anymore. But when we're talking about Sirius and Orion and the Pleiades, it's still there, isn't it? You can still see it.
Ah, you've done your homework. I love it when people are prepared for an interview. Well, it's a big curiosity, and one of the key things that I've used, and it's proven to be remarkably accurate, is Starry Night Pro, which mm-hmm. is a very sophisticated computer program that is basically tracking the movement of everything in the heavens. And I don't know how they put it together, but it seems that the ancients had access to this degree of knowledge because they were tracking this sort of thing. But I was able to go in there and show different things by looking at what the ancients had plotted and then moving them through space and time, because you can go back 99,999 BC and forward to that many AD and see how these configurations of the major sky-ground correlation in Giza and in other places in the world are part of this configuration. So someone said once that one of the shafts in the Queen's Chamber always points to Sirius. And I had a discussion with Robert Bovall about this, who's the one who discovered the Orion correlation for the Giza pyramids. And he said, well, that's impossible. How could that ever happen? And then we came upon Walter Cruttenden, and both of these are in the Pyramid Code, both of them. And he was looking at, he's got a book called Lost Star of Myth and Time, and he looked at all the mythology that showed that we could be in a binary star system. He's got the Binary Research Institute. And he's looking at all the different legends about Sirius and Earth. And he's mm-hmm. proposing this idea that if we were in a binary system, it would take 13,000 years for us to come, for the orbits to come close together, and then 13,000 years for them to be far apart. And that when we're spiraling away, we lose energy and we're dumber. And when we're spiraling toward and close, we're in the golden age and we're more activated. But he was hypothesizing this on a theoretical, mythological basis. So I went into Starry Night and I put in Sirius and our solar system and the various constellations that you were, planetary systems that you mentioned. And with the extra galactic grid, Sirius stays in the middle, and mm-hmm. the Earth indeed is dancing with it in an orbit that it never leaves. And the Dogons knew this. Many, many, many different tribes and indigenous people talked about it. And so, but what else is that Sirius, if we imagine that to be Abu Roush, which is north of the Great Pyramid, and then Orion, and then the Pleiades, no matter what you do, no matter when in space and time, they never separate. And they keep going along this extragalactic meridian straight through Cygnus. And Cygnus is the bird mm-hmm. that goes straight down the spine of the bird. And if you keep going in a straight line from the beak, what do you come to? The galactic center.
Mm-hmm.
And so how the ancients knew that is absolutely riveting. And the fact that, you know, we need these sophisticated computer programs to even check this sort of thing is mind-boggling. Really.
Which points to the fact that they obviously had technologies that we can't even fathom at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. And they say, well, if they had diamond drill bits, find me a diamond drill bit. Well, you know, three world floods later, I mean, if we dropped a diamond drill bit in your lawn right now, we wouldn't find it either. Mm-hmm. And so, but the evidence of something that was carved with a diamond drill bit is there, right? So, yes, and we have found things. That's the thing with forbidden archaeology is that it's a known fact that if things don't fit with the storyline of the powers that were, they throw it out. And so we have found these sophisticated devices that are like computers that are all rusted over that were found in, you know, sunken treasure on a boat kind of thing under the water. We found all kinds of things that indicate, and even the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, there's the round zodiac that Napoleon brought to the Louvre, and now what's there is a replica. But they've just cleaned the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera in the first hypostyle hall, and the whole story of the mythical beings and the half-animal, half-human, and the procession of the equinoxes is there with the four-winged, two-headed ram. It's all there. The cycles, the zodiac, everything moving through the body of Nui, which is a chapter in my book. It's just, we know how to look. We're looking in the right place. It's much easier to perceive it.
One of the things I'd like to talk about that I have a question about, and this may be, again, open for discussion, because it's not an easy thing to necessarily prove, but if we're looking at the fact, or we're considering the precession of the equinox, and then we look at the Vedic cycles, which say that Egypt would have been at one point in time the Golden Age, and right now we are in the Iron Age. But if you look at the Mayan calendar, and I'm talking about the work of Dr. Carl Kellerman, for example, and we're coming to the end of his perception of the Mayan calendar, which there's debate about what that timeline is, whether it's October 28th or it's 2011 or it's December 21st, 2012. But if we look at this time acceleration model, would you say that moving through the Iron Age and moving back into the Bronze and Silver and Golden Age, is it going to be, I mean, rationale would say it's going to take us another 13,000 years to get there, but is that what you have, you know, kind of pieced together, that we're going to move through some time acceleration, we're going to get there quicker, or, are we, you know, what have you come up with in looking at that?
Well, thank you for that question, because there's a lot in it, and I can hear what you're asking me, and I have thought about this a great deal, and it's I don't even know where to start, but I'll start with Kellerman. We're in the ninth wave now, and he has made some good analyses about how we go through the 7 days, like that God created the earth in 7 days, which is 6 days,
Seven days and six nights.
Mm-hmm. And it's 13, though. It goes
right
on 13. And we are accelerated now to be going through these in a few days, as opposed to last year when we were going through we were going through stages every 360 days. And so that has been a compressed time. Now, the end of this last layer is October 28, 2011. But there's one more step on the top. And so, for sure, through Starry Night, I'm absolutely certain that the galactic alignment, we have been touching, like I'm going to just describe, if you look at 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, winter solstice, the alignment isn't straight through the sun in the center of the galaxy, but it's touching the edge of the sun. So if you can imagine holding a pen up to a cup, in 2008, it touched the rim, and in 2012, it's right through the center, and the steps 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 are moving you toward. So in an astrological sense, we've touched that energy, but people say 11, 11 in the morning on December 21st. No, it is Giza sunset, December 21st, 2012, is when the sun is lined up exactly. But as I said, we've been touching the energy and moving out of it.
Right.
Now, another perspective, and this rings true because of the depictions on the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, which we've only been able to analyze recently because it used to be this taupey dark brown over the top, and the images are 40 feet up. And so even for photographing it, it's been impossible. But I went in there with an 18-megapixel camera and took pictures of it now that it's clean. And there's some very curious things in there. And one of them is a ram, two-headed, one looking in the 13,000 direction one way and then the 13,000 the other way with two wings, meaning that it's 6,500 years divided, multiplied by four, the 26,000-year cycle is divided into 6,500-year chunks. Now, that's not how it looks, and that's not how it was depicted through Walter Crittenden's movie The Great Year, or even in the Pyramid Code, because it looks like the Golden Age is bigger and the Iron Age is less. However, Jay Widener came up with something, and he takes it like an inverted pyramid and then one that's right side up, And so the golden, the Iron Age is pushing us down through the eye of the needle, where things are going faster, 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 faster. And as we push into the energy of the Golden Age and get through the eye of the needle, which we're very, very close to, and it feels like we're being compressed through an eye of a needle,
mm-hmm.
and and all the karma has to come off before we go through, then we're into a different space-time continuum where it feels more open and slow, like kind of thing.
Right.
And so the Bronze Age and the Silver Age are sitting in the other wing of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think it's going to take 13,000 years. In fact, we have been, I think that the significance of the Mayan calendar, it's like all other time other than that has been matriarchal. And in this particular period of time, it's been the denigration of the feminine. And everything in Egypt is about the balance. And then we had the pharaonic period that looked like it was warring, and then things that percolated up, particularly in the 18th dynasty when Hatshepsut and Akhenaten and Nefertiti and Tut came along in different periods of the 18th dynasty. So the true spirituality came back. And so I think that what we have had an opportunity to be existing in a completely different way, but it's the powers that were that have been holding it, holding humanity, stranglehold slaves, mentality that, you know, and keeping prosperity from us and that sort of thing, I think that's scheduled to end.
Mm-hmm.
And the Federal Reserve Act actually runs out at midnight, December 21st, 2012. Is that an artificial date? And then they're saying Armageddon and it's all going to be, you know, everything's going to blow up and all this, but they're using footage from tsunamis and earthquakes that already happened. Mm-hmm. And so this fear-mongering is a completely different system. I don't think that that's really what's the real trajectory of humanity. And so I think we're in for some pretty good news, and that the stranglehold that the corrupt criminals, governments, have had on us will come to an end. So, no, I don't think it's going to take 13,000 years for us to rebuild. There is enough money and resources on the planet to take care of everyone happily. But there's been various reasons why we have not been able to connect with that, and I think that's coming to an end. Now, the Nag Hammadi texts were found in 1945 very close to the Temple of Dendera. And the Nile River, also if you stand on the sea, on the roof of it, you can see the river is quite a distance away, which to me indicates the antiquity of the original temple. And there are places in that temple where you can see there's a temple underneath it, and so you know, even older, because older is deeper. And the Nag Hammadi texts are written from the perspective of a divine feminine being. And so it's not a god with a thunderbolt in the sky that's doing surveillance that's going to punish you and strike you down that you have to have faith in.
Mm-hmm.
It is an interactive goddess whose body is the earth, who we are interactive with, she has faith in us. And so by replacing the cultural myth, it's, you know, legitimized war and my God's better than your God, and all of these problems have come from the rewriting and then hiding of these texts. So when they were found, they were given to Christians to decipher, and it took them like 21 years, and they came out with all kinds of mistakes in prepositions and even gender. Like when you're translating from, like, think about Chinese. Chinese people who are learning English don't conjugate verbs well. They don't understand the difference between he and she, and the prepositions don't, they sit in a chair and we sit on a chair. And so these sorts of things, by translating an old language, are easy to make. And even Sitchin made those kinds of mistakes, you know, in terms of the translation of the Sumerian texts. So because they weren't mystics, the ones that were translating the Nag Hammadi texts, and because they had the Christian agenda, there's no way we're going to get the real story out of it. And then they kept them hidden for 21 years. Well, does it really take 21 years to translate something if you've got the dictionary and the way to do it? And so everything has been about obscuring the truth. And one of the reasons why psychics who are, you know, were pretty good, even Nostradamus looking into the future, have not been able to look beyond 2012 is we're moving into a different system, a different way of the whole energetics. To manifest, and we are to interact. So that's why it's really important for us to stay positive, and we are creating, we're co-creating with Gaia Sophia. And so that's why we can't predict what's going to happen, because we have to do it. So as long as they're feeding us fear and they're, you know, people are losing their houses and their jobs and everything else and people are dying and we're all stuck in grief, then we are feeding the old system. So that's something that, you know, Interactive You wants to feed the new system and empower humans instead of disempowering them.
And when we're talking about the empowered human that you have, you know, that section that you have in the Pyramid Code, and we're looking at what the Egyptians did, the rites that people had to go through in order to handle the different, well, different levels of consciousness, but also the energy that was coming in. And as we go through some of these cycles, you know, whether it's eclipses or new moons or the solstice and the equinox, and we're moving towards this center point, you know, I'm flashing on the fact that it's our physical bodies, again, awakening to this power that's coming in, but it's not always easy because we don't have the same level of training. We've formed these informal groups that are helping us all through this, and I think it's in our consciousness, but I find it fascinating that as we're becoming more empowered, we're still having to deal with, you know, higher levels of energy, and these, we're moving up the, you know, the evolution of consciousness. It's similar to what, you know, the Egyptians, I think, had to go through, or what some of their processes were. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Sure. I love your questions. So I've got two comments. One is that when I was guided to do the Pyramid Code, I was told that it was to trigger high-level initiates who remembered a time in the Golden Age in Egypt. And that's precisely what's happened. I've gotten a number of thousands of emails from people who are like, oh, I just didn't know how to articulate that, but I know you're right, sort of thing, right? And so they are triggered because they already know, and I suggest that you're probably one of those people. The second point is that when I would see reenactments from ancient Egypt, I would just laugh because the actors are standing, and they're not standing in a way that would allow them to receive the amount of energy that would have been coming down. And so the actors weren't trained either in receiving this amount of energy. And my third point is when you look in Abydos and various frescoes in Egypt, you'll see that they're wearing bands on their forearms, wrists, and ankles. And my information is that when they did the sex magic rites, the initiates were trained, the males were trained separate from the females, and they would come together in the field. And these bands, the armbands were for the sex magic, meaning that they had trained so that they understood how to take this physical energy and process it through their bodies. I'm not talking about sexuality. I'm talking about the high-level energy that is available that comes through that. And then the wrist and ankle bands were to hold a larger space so they didn't get, and forgive the made-up word, electromagneticuted, that if too much energy came through, they would die. And so the trainings along the temples of the Nile started at the base chakra at the Temple of Isis, and that was moved due to the Aswan Dam. So the chakra system had scoliosis, and it needed to get reconnected. But then they would go, you know, the belly chakra and deal with their fears at Kamumbo, and they'd swim with alligators and their crocodiles, sorry, and then go up through to the higher chakras that arrived at Giza. And it was only, and once the high-level initiates arrived there, they would never leave. They would, you know, be bare feet. They would arrive on the boats right at the foot of the pyramids, and they would arrive blindfolded. And my information is naked, and they would step, and they'd get a robe, and they would be in this protected environment, and they would be working as part of the machinery as human divining rods. That we're working in association just the way neural synapses don't touch. They send a hormone across, and that's how our brain communicates for us to lift our arm or whatever else we're doing. And so this energy was incredibly strong. And we have no idea because we are dumbed down. So we went from 12-strand DNA to 2-strand, and now some of us are rebuilding 2 to 3 to 6 to 9 to 12. And so this is what we are dealing with, and we are increasing our capacity to deal with this incredibly intense cosmic energy. But what it does is it brings higher level consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, there's certain things that run counter to it. Synthetics, being in a city, you know, run away, fluorescent lights.
Electromagnetic frequency.
All that stuff is the opposite. Mm-hmm. And being in nature and communing and meditating and doing a discipline, you know, Tai Chi, Qigong, any of that stuff, builds our capacity. Clearing our karma builds our capacity. Building more karma takes it away. So in our society, if you don't get caught, it's not wrong. Well, yeah, but the truth is still there. So most of us who have been kind of playing the line and going along with, you know, aspartame and fluoride in the water and the chemtrails and all the different pharmaceuticals, I mean, it's got to go. It's all synthetic and it's all damaging to the human. And so we've had so much influence of all of these different things. But there are people who stepped outside of the system who, you know, but now they don't want us to grow our own food and all of that. So, the system has been absolutely diametrically opposed to us discovering what we're talking about here.
Absolutely. To have any kind of personal growth or uniqueness or just connected to our own, you know, power, it's totally tried to dumb us down. But, you know, now I think it's becoming so transparent that that is what the agenda is. And when you're saying about, you know, if nobody knows about it and you don't get caught, it's okay. But even now it's getting harder and harder not to get caught because, you know, it's almost like the system is working against itself in some ways, and it's bringing in more light into some of these situations.
Yep. It's too late.
Yep.
The gig's up.
Well, let's talk now a little bit before we finish. And again, this hour's flying by. But, you know, so we've been in this patriarchal energy for the last 5,000 years. But what was the balance between the masculine and the feminine? From your research, what did that look like? And where does it seem that we're moving into with regards to, you know, this reawakening of the feminine in order to create the balance between the masculine and the feminine?
Okay. Well, everything has to exist in a balance or it won't work. And so there are several levels of symbolism in Egypt. And it's around the world as well. I mean, as you know, I've been to many countries, but my focus has been on Egypt because the story is there so plain to see. So before you went into a temple, if you look up, any temple has a winged disc. And so there's serpents, which are the symbol of the sacred masculine, and the vulture, which is the sacred feminine. So the bird can walk on the earth and fly. And so that's a symbol that we are spiritual beings having an earth experience. So the way temples are set up, they're almost like the cavities of the human body, and they're resonance fields. And the Holy of Holies is the pineal gland, and that's the master gland that runs our consciousness. And so, and the glandular system follows along with the chakras. And so, of course, the feminine can procreate. So Freud came along and called it penis envy, but really it's procreation envy. And
right.
So the feminine leads slightly because she's giving birth.
Mm-hmm.
But the masculine has to be honored in balance. So when an initiate or anyone in the populace would arrive at the temple, they would surrender their lower self to their higher self, note the balance between the masculine and feminine, and walk through the gateway with the winged disc above their heads into the first hypostyle hall. Now, the levels of initiation would allow you to move further forward, and so typically an average person in the populace couldn't go beyond the first. But then you'll see at the entrance to the Holy of Holies of Karnak, which is one of the largest temples, there is a lotus flower pillar and a papyrus flower pillar. And again, the symbol, the feminine is the lotus, the masculine is the papyrus being paper, the first paper, writing things down, concrete, left brain, and the lotus is in water, giving birth into water, and it's the symbol of the sacred feminine. So you would see, there's images of King Tut, for example, the head of King Tut being born out of a lotus. And so once you start to see the lotus flowers and the papyrus and the offerings and all of that sort of thing, that's the masculine and feminine. And there's a third level of that, which is the Djed, which is the spinal cord of Osiris, and the Teat, it's called, which is an Ankh with the arms down. And you'll see double masculine, double feminine, double masculine, double feminine. So two of each in rows. And you see that over and over and over again. All of these symbols are just repeated and repeated and repeated in Egypt, but most people don't know what they're looking at. But all the way around the gold shrine of King Tut was this double masculine, double feminine, which is basically the protection that when you disincarnate and transmute the transmutation of the soul to another level, and because there's the part of the soul that never dies, there's the Ba, which is the body double, which is the one that will bilocate, and then the Ka is the double, and the Ba is the part of you that doesn't die. So you meet Anubis, and he says, you're dead, and you go, I am, I feel the same. But when you're moving through the bardos to go beyond the realms of the dense physical, it's the balance of the double masculine and the double feminine that protect you, or else you get fried up and can't go. And so by denigrating the feminine, by saying Mary Magdalene was a prostitute, even though she was a high-level initiate who trained Jesus, by, you know, putting only men, old men, in suits in government and having very little representation or value of the feminine, our whole, it's just a failed experiment. I mean, look at the trouble we're in because we're not respecting Mother Earth.
Right.
And so just a case and just a fact here is that did you know that Bolivia recently is the first country that has created a law and legislation that says that Mother Earth herself has rights?
I saw that recently. I thought it was beautiful. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so that's where we have to go. We have to honor everything. And so we have, you know, it's not that hard to figure it out and to come back. But the lack of balance is probably the simplest way to describe our demise.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if it's concrete, reading, writing, arithmetic, if you can see something, you know, it's concrete, it's real in this world. But if it's a dream or a vision or something like that, we don't count that as real. Well, that's feminine consciousness. It's periodicity, it's magic, right? It's symbolic. And again, if we just live there, well, then we're just in la-la land. And so we have to come back and verify. So it's the interaction between both sides. But we also don't value that, you know? So that's what has to happen. And so the Egyptians, they even had these gold crowns that would have like a serpent going along the midpoint of the brain to activate it,
mm-hmm.
right? So the importance of the two sides communicating with each other were essential. So what you'll see is it's manifested in the symbolism as two left hands or two right hands. And people say, oh, those Egyptians, they didn't really know how to draw hands. But the left hands give and the right hands receive. And when you're deciphering what you're looking at in a fresco, if you look and the pharaoh's got one big foot, right foot forward, because, you know, the right side and the left side are the masculine and the feminine,
mm-hmm.
he's walking forward with masculine energy. But when you see the goddess, you never see their feet together. There's one foot is slightly forward, and it's the left side that's forward, which is saying we have balance, but we slightly lead with the feminine, which means we slightly lead with the dream, the vision, the unseen, the cosmic,
mm-hmm.
like that. And so that's how the masculine and feminine are manifested in Egypt.
And if that is what we're moving into, a more balanced state of awareness, you can see why all our structures, you know, when I think about, again, the school system or the governmental system or the banking system or whatever is going on that's a structure or the, you know, medical system, for example, with the not recognizing that intuitive healing side of things, why all of that is under such stress right now, because as this patriarchal model kind of starts to disintegrate and we move into a more balanced state of awareness, none of those can be held up.
Not the way they are, because the doctor's God, don't ask any questions, take this, I know, you don't, instead
mm-hmm.
of a person saying, well, let me go and look and decide what kind of, you know, treatment I want. Oh, no, you can't do that. And so, yes, all of that is completely breaking apart. But the thing, too, that people often don't understand is that there is a sacred feminine inside a man. And there's a sacred masculine inside a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, perhaps our society has allowed women the freedom to work and that sort of thing, and so women tend to be a little more balanced because they've activated their masculine by, you know, doing their own finances and getting organized in the business world, right? But now you see men being absolutely loving and charming with their children and men are coming around to understanding their feminine. Now, the systems perhaps aren't representing that, but real people are.
Yeah, I've always contended, you know, when people, I always say that there's, when something looks negative, there's always a positive aspect. And I know, you know, there's so many people that comment on the fact that about broken homes and this kind of thing. But what I see as a positive is it's really called men to get in touch with their feminine, because they have to keep a house, they have to cook for their children, they have to nurture them and read them bedtime stories. And that all gets them in touch with that feminine essence that they really, you know, have been out of touch with for so long. They've not been allowed to go there. So, you know, it really has shifted, especially in the last, you know, 10 or 20 years, there's been that big shift in the masculine.
And how beautiful is it to look out your eyes in public and see men with their children who are obviously loving and connected? It's a beautiful thing. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
They're happier with it, too.
They absolutely are. You know, I think it gives them a sense of freedom, and it's allowing them to go there where under other conditions they wouldn't be able to go there. So, you know, I mean, through all these changes, although at times, you know, regardless of what area we're talking about, there seems like there's upheaval, there's always something great being birthed out of it. And I just want to thank you today for sharing. You know, you have so much information. We've just touched on tidbits of it, but please tell people how they can get in touch with you, and if they're interested in your books and your DVD and Interactive You, how they can reach you.
Well, pyramidcode.com is the main website that deals with this series and that sort of thing, and I'm just updating it. Within 2 or 3 days, the new site will be up. Though there's one, the old one's still there. Interactive You, I'm building it next, and that'll take... It may take me a month to get it up, and it's spelled interactive dash capital U. Well, it doesn't have to be capital, but the letter U, .com.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be announcing that as time goes on the Pyramid Code website, and all my contact information is there. Amazon.com, and there's PAL versions in Europe of the Pyramid Code. It's on Netflix. Coming to Canada soon, but definitely in the States. And so just Google it, and you'll find it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And for everyone else out there, if you want to get in touch with me, my email is Cyrilla, C-Y-R-I-L-L-A, at Aspiro, A-S-P-I-R-O, lifestyle.ca. And until next time, keep your energy flowing. Namaste.